You know, sometimes I just don't get it. Maybe our first guest will explain to me what I should be getting, but sometimes I just don't get it. We spent over the past 8-9 days bringing some of the most vital, vibrant, compelling personalities in Canada who are working on issues of social action at home and abroad, who are bringing the important issues of our society to bear, not the statocratic engineering of our governments, but issues of hunger, homelessness, elder abuse. People from Vancouver who are working for women in Afghanistan, people in Montreal who are taking up the case and cause of the devastated of Darfur. It's been a remarkable 8-9 days. I can't think of anybody better than our first guest, who I'll introduce in a moment, to wrap it up and to sum up where we should be heading. But I had to make a comment as I flipped through the papers over the past day or two of how I'm hoping that you get it out there. I'm really hoping that this country can get it. I'm really hoping that this country understands the difference between democracy and freedom. And when there's a choice between the two, you choose freedom. Democracy doesn't mean freedom. I'm hoping that Canadians understand the importance of their own individual consequence. But when I open a paper today, and the headline editorial, the first editorial, "It's time to get tough to make teens buckle up." I mean, really. And then I go to another newspaper, and we see that starting today, a new law is coming into effect in Ontario that will impose severe fines if parents don't have booster seats for children until they're either 9 years old or are 110 centimeters high. Then looking across the past year, we see that Statistics Canada spent millions of dollars conducting a national study of 4,000 youngsters that proved the obvious, or at least proved conventional wisdom, that girls scored higher than boys in almost all categories except curiosity. I'm not sure we needed to know that or spend millions of dollars to study it. StatsCan then went on to do another thing called the General Social Survey that found that heavy internet users tend to be homebodies who show less interest in outdoor activities. Yet another StatsCan study that was widely reported because it showed that more people enjoyed their commute than did not. Who cares? Who cares? We live in a country where the elderly, who should be enjoying the best years of their life amidst the wonders they've built, most of them are living below the poverty line. We live in a nation where, according to the Center for Policy Alternatives, 48% of working Canadians are one paycheck away from financial disaster. We live in a country where 34% of urban households are below federal poverty lines, according to the Institute for the Family. And our politicians won't concentrate on what's critical, because they haven't got the will or the wit to roll back the statocratic programs that gives them more power through bureaucrats to address the real issues. I hope all of you get it. I certainly know our first guest gets it. And I'm going to introduce him and his views right after this short break. Gives of his time to the city that he lives in, his adopted city of Toronto through the Toronto City Alliance. That's not enough to say anything about David Picot. David Picot and his work has tried to focus the attention of community leaders and governments on a very simple theme. And that theme was expressed in a paper that he co-wrote with Susan Piggott called "Time for a Fair Deal for Low-Income Canadians." I'm just going to give you a short synopsis from it. From his words, "Anyone working full-time should be able to keep themselves and their families out of poverty. Yet nearly a third of Canada's low-wage workers can't make ends meet. This is not because they don't work hard, but because they can't earn enough to cover what it costs to live and work in this country, especially in larger cities. Canada's future prosperity depends on having a labor force operating at full capacity, particularly as our society ages. We must ensure all working-age adults are contributing to our economy. Immigration partly answers our labor market needs, but getting the full participation of everyone already in the labor force in Canada is critical." David Picot, thanks very much for taking the time to be with us.
Well, it's great to be with you. Thanks.
David, you, in those two paragraphs, you summarize what we've gone over in 8 days with people in various aspects of social action, and what you've written has been confirmed through the Center of Policy Alternatives, the Vanier Institute for the Family, the Old Brewery Mission, the people working on hunger. And as you heard when I intro the show, and I just had to take some time out of our interview because I looked at the papers today, and tell me why I shouldn't be enraged, never mind angry. What is it in this country that has leaders like you, civic leaders, people with credibility in business, and all we get are statocratic pieces of nonsense of how do we protect little Johnny and how do we make everything more safe and secure, instead of how do we make things better and how does our society give the basic services for which we cede our liberties to the state?
I think sometimes the whole issue of poverty and particularly people who are working full time and still living in poverty feels like one of those hills that Sisyphus is pushing the rock up, and you say, oh my God, there's just no way we can ever get our arms around it or be able to get to the top of that hill. But that's a complete cop out, because the reality is the solutions are at hand, and they go back to how we manage the tax system. And the level at which we set the minimum wage, the ways in which we encourage people to participate in the labor force, and it truly is a problem that can be addressed. But I agree with you. I think we spend far too much time on things of far lesser consequence, and it's no credit to us as a society that we haven't come to grips with this issue.
Is one of our problems a mindset issue? I'm reminded last year when the textile industry in this country, particularly in Quebec, was hard hit. 40,000 jobs were lost. And then Liberal Industry Minister David Emerson said, well, the textile industry simply has to reinvent itself because business wants cheap labor, slave labor in China, and through our EDC, we're actually helping that. That's a policy issue. Do people not understand what's happening, or nobody has the guts to snap and say, hey, this is wrong? If a society cannot protect its jobs and has, as a first step to getting people out of poverty, never mind all the social programs, but just the job market, and we're subsidizing a slave job market as an alternative, there's something fundamentally wrong with the nature of what we are as Canadians. We're not the good and gentle, true north, strong and free, are we?
Well, I think if you look at the kinds of jobs that low wage workers are in today, even the ones that have moved offshore are still a small percentage of the total jobs. Many of the hundreds of thousands of people in Canada who are earning minimum wage are in, you know, they're the people who served you hamburgers today, they're the people who took care of your children today, they're the people who have been working in the hospital taking care of your aging parents. When you look at the jobs they perform, and how much we count on them to take care of ourselves and our family and our children, it's shocking that we are willing to let them live in poverty, even aside from the moral concerns here. Because the fact is, we need these people's labor, we need their talents. And, you know, today, I mean, you were talking about seniors, and I do think we have significant issues with senior poverty. And yet, in Ontario and in Quebec, someone working minimum wage, working at the available hours full year, makes several thousand dollars less than a senior. So even as badly as we've taken care of our seniors, people working full-time at minimum wage are worse off, certainly in Ontario, than our seniors are. Even the poorest senior in Ontario makes more than the average person earning minimum wage in Ontario, which seems crazy when you tell that to a business person. That's why when I talk to business people about these issues and they understand the facts, they get pretty angry and pretty upset when they realize that for many people on welfare, to come off of welfare and start working, they'll actually lose more in benefits and be worse off than they were before going to work. And they call this the welfare wall. And across the country, I think we've got to tackle these issues to make work pay and to enable people who are working to be able to support their families.
We're going to take a very short break, but when we come back, I want to go through some of the 8 points that you and Susan Pigott made in the Time for a Fair Deal for Low-Income Canadians proposal, and to see where, if anywhere, we've gotten with any of this. We'll be right back with David Picot right after this. And a very special guest tonight, and I thank him for taking the time to be with us the beginning of the year when most people are out, is David Picot, a partner in the Boston Consulting Group, a co-founder of the Toronto Summit City Alliance, co-chair of the Task Force on Modernizing Income Security for Working-Age Adults, and he and Susan Piggott wrote a paper some time ago, and David was with us then, Time for a Fair Deal for Low-Income Canadians. David Picot is one of the rare people who straddles the world of business, the world of social action, and these recommendations, and you will hear the threads of what we've been talking about for 10 days with social action leaders, with business leaders on the show in the past 2 weeks. Employment insurance needs to be revamped to broaden coverage and turn the system to a true insurance program for the unemployed. Two, Ottawa should introduce a new national refundable tax credit and working income supplement to support low-income Canadians. Three, the federal government should provide a national disability support program for Canadians whose disabilities are so substantial they can't work. Four, minimum wages, a provincial matter, need to be part of a comprehensive approach to boosting incomes. Five, with the increase in the number of workers in temporary jobs, provinces need to strengthen the enforcement of employment standards and ensure that legal protections currently in place for full-time employees cover new forms of work. Six, provinces should have a child benefit program for all low-income families that will integrate seamlessly with the national child benefit. Eight, provinces should bear most of the social assistance costs, not municipalities. David Picot, this is a blueprint for streamlining a system for income security in this country. What don't the politicians get in this? This is not difficult to do. The one thing that may be that may face opposition is you, I think rightly, put the stress on a stronger centralized national government, which of course the provinces may not like. But what parts of this don't they get?
Well, it's interesting. You know, as you know, Beryl, we had a task force that had business leaders, nonprofit leaders, and we had ex officio membership from the federal government and the province of Ontario and some others from around the country. That process we went through last year with the task force does seem to be getting some traction, and there have been a couple silver linings, positive things come out in the last 2 months. One I would point to is Minister Flaherty, our finance minister,
right,
in his economic update this fall, for the first time said that the federal government was going to specifically pursue a income supplement for the working poor. And he made a point in his update of saying that people who are low-income Canadians who start working can lose as much as 80 cents on the dollar to taxes and reduced income support when they begin to work. And he said in his upcoming budget he's going to try to address that with an income supplement through the tax system. So to me, that was as close as we've seen in a commitment. The Liberals before in the previous election had said something similar, that they were going to look at this, and Goodell in his last budget talked in his economic statement talked about this. So that may be the beginnings of a national commitment to this, and I think we can all put as much pressure as possible between now and the budget due in the spring to see that actually come in with the budget. And if it did come in and got support from the other parties, which I would hope it would, that might be the beginnings of a national program here. Personally, I think the provinces should welcome that. The income tax system has been used for redistributive purposes before. We have an old age supplement that's a national mm-hmm. program that all the provinces support. What we're really looking for is to extend that concept to working age adults. And we also have a national child benefit. So, I mean, we have two of the three planks we need. They need to be better funded, but we have support to poor seniors. We have support to poor children. What we haven't had is a national commitment to poor adults. And if you put that third piece in place, then you have the beginnings of a framework that can really address poverty as a whole.
Let me ask you this on a broader question arising out of this, these issues. We've heard over the past 2 weeks, we've heard for you for some time, but particularly over the past 2 weeks, both from organizations like the Center for Policy Alternatives, the Vanier Institute for the Family, and broader economic institutes like CD Howe and even the Fraser Institute, that one of the problems of working-class Canadians is that you've got incredibly severe tax rates paying for government programs, as I described at the beginning of the show, that are really unnecessary. We need a rollback in government programs in order to reduce the tax burden so that people can move out of poverty, those that are working. Can any of this really be accomplished without a significant rollback in government programs at all levels that have nothing to do with the delivery of the fundamental services for which government is elected to do?
Well, I think you make a great point that for the poor, we're really talking about tax relief, because even someone earning minimum wage is paying thousands of dollars in CPP, employment insurance premiums and income tax. In fact, taxes in Canada kick in at a much earlier level with poor people than almost any other OECD country, which not many Canadians realize. So I think part of this can be positioned very much as tax relief for the poor. In terms of whether you have to cut government programs to get there, I think at the federal level we've seen them running up significant surpluses, and it seems to me that this ought to be a priority for any tax relief federally, is to focus it on the poor. And one of the concerns I have is that we would see tax relief in the next budget, but it might not get down to the level of really addressing the needs of the poor in Canada. And so I hope that's a priority in any tax relief that comes down from the federal government.
David Pico, I would ask you, we're running a little later than I told you. I'm wondering if you have another 5 minutes, because I want to address the UNESCO issue with you on the flip side of our next break. Well, thank you, David. We'll be right back with David Pico on the other side of this. And we're talking with David Pico, partner in the Boston consulting firm, co-founder of the Toronto City Summit Alliance, one of the leading organizations that's bringing business and social action leaders together on resolving problems, our most critical social issues, co-author with Susan Piggott on the Task Force on Modernizing Income Security for Working-Age Adults, wrote a very compelling paper called Time for a Fair Deal for Low-Income Canadians. Let's hear from you. Do you think you have a fair deal? And David, thank you for your patience. I wanted to address two more questions. You can do it as briefly or as much length as you like. One, is it really possible to address the national problems of economic disparity in this country at a time of devolution of federal powers? Do we not need a strong national government rather than a community of communities, everybody bickering about their territorial imperatives at the provincial level? And two, when you and Susan wrote Time for a Fair Deal, your opening comment was that the United Nations Committee on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights reported that Canada's minimum wages are inadequate for workers and their families to enjoy a decent standard of living. We couldn't agree more. There's been some debate recently on whether minimum wages should be lowered rather than raised, because somehow they're a detriment to the growth of jobs and prosperity. Could you address those two points, please?
Sure. On the first one about devolution, Beryl, my strong view is that the recommendations we made, which were, as you recall and had talked about before the break, a national tax credit for the working poor, right, a revamping of our employment insurance program, which only covers less than half the people who are actually unemployed, so it's not really an unemployment insurance program anymore, and then a disability income support program. Those recommendations fit very well within the mandate of a national government, and I think that all three of those are areas where I think the provinces could agree that the federal government could play a meaningful and logical role, and that as a right of citizenship, Canadians should be entitled to a programs of employment insurance and an income supplement that really works. So it seems to me the way forward is to focus on those things that the federal government can do well and then leave the other areas to provincial jurisdiction. On your second point on the minimum wage, the problem with attacking any of these issues of poverty from only one direction is you'll never get a good solution. So minimum wage has to be part of the solution. All the studies we looked at, and we looked at over 50 studies from Canada, the United States, and Europe, indicate that a very, you know, modest and regular increase in the minimum wage does not appear to kill jobs. Obviously, if you jump the minimum wage quite substantially in a very short time, that may not be true, and you may have a problem. The one exception is young people. You know, if you've got teenagers who are working part time and that sort of thing, there can be issues, and most provinces have a special program for young adults, and also limit significantly where and when they can work in order to protect them. But clearly minimum wage increases need to be part of it. And the problem we had in Ontario for many years was we had almost a decade with no increase in the minimum wage, which meant with inflation, in effect, the minimum wage went down substantially, almost 40%. I think you just had an announcement in Quebec of the minimum wage being raised up to $8 this summer, which gets it up to the level that Ontario will also be at this spring. But this has to be done on a regular basis, and it's the only way that you can protect a lot of low-income workers.
David Pico, I thank you very much for taking time to be with us. I encourage everybody to go to your websites, go to your computers, check out this paper, check out the writings and the work of David Pico. David, you make it clear, your clarity and your courage and your foresight of thought can gentle the condition of this land in a very real sense if Canadians finally take this to heart and don't just repeat platitudes about how good we are and really get down to the real business of government and the real work of relieving suffering. And we thank you for your service, and we thank you for your time.
Well, thank you for paying attention to these issues, Beryl. It's greatly appreciated.
Have a good night.
Thank you.
Montreal, we'll be right back on the flip side of the break. And in light of Saddam Hussein's execution, we're going to be discussing the issue of beyond impunity. Can international criminal justice prevent future atrocities? With a remarkable law professor, main trial. What if this was a failed opportunity to show the world, and particularly perhaps the Muslim Middle East and some of the revanchist groups, exactly what had been going on? Where does it go from here in terms of Iraq, if you can speculate just for a moment, internally after the execution? What does it do to the conflict between the Shiites and the Sunnis?
Fortunately, it has only exacerbated the deep rifts which exist between Sunnis and Shiites. I had advised the Iraqi National Congress prior to the invasion to set up a United Nations tribunal, maybe a mixed tribunal with both UN and Iraqi judges, so you have the domestic sense of ownership and international legitimacy and expertise. And because of U.S. pressure, they decided to go in favor of this special tribunal, which was established under Iraqi law. Now, I think that the trial is now being perceived as an act of revenge by Shiites against the Sunni. And in that sense, the trial, which could have been a basis for national reconciliation, has only exacerbated the situation. And we must also remember that we are dealing with a situation of civil war, border civil war, in which Shiite forces now are committing atrocities, and there are reciprocal atrocities by the Sunnis. So the message is not somehow that the new Iraq is going to be governed by the rule of law and by due process. The message is that we have executed Saddam Hussein as an act of vengeance. We've given him his just deserts. So in that sense, I don't think that the tribunal will really contribute much. But the other question is that the lessons of the Saddam Hussein trial are not just for the Iraqi people, but it's also for the international community. This goes back to what you mentioned about the responsibility to protect. Mm-hmm. The Anfal campaign, which was the first use of poison gas against women and children since the Holocaust, this was against the Kurds of northern Iraq, was one of the darkest periods in the history of U.S. foreign policy. The United States, throughout the Iran-Iraq war in the 1980s, actively supported Saddam Hussein. And in this particular case, after the gassing of Iraqi civilians, when the U.S. Congress attempted to impose sanctions on Iraq, the Bush White House essentially vetoed it. So the lessons which we have to learn, especially in the context of the Middle East also, is that that this kind of cynical realpolitik is eventually come back to haunt us. U.S. support for Saddam Hussein clearly came back to haunt the international community after the invasion of Kuwait, support for the Taliban in Afghanistan. So there is this much bigger lesson that we have to learn, that we must intervene when atrocities are ongoing as a matter of principle, and not simply administer justice after the fact in a very sort of
and not even just because of recent law like the ICCIS and the responsibility to protect, but if there is any meaning to come out of a century of blood that preceded us, it is the Nuremberg principles that almost obligates nations to act when those atrocities are being committed.
Exactly. And I think what we have in the case of Bosnia, in the case of Rwanda and the Darfur, is a model where we sit by as spectators while genocide is committed and then administer justice after the fact. And one of the lessons of Nuremberg, people sort of have criticized it as victor's justice, but in the case of Nuremberg, Churchill simply wanted to line up the top Nazi leaders and execute them. And it was Justice Jackson, it was President Roosevelt, President Truman, that insisted that we must stay the hand of vengeance. And as an essential part of the denazification process, have civilized rules, have due process. And that's why Nuremberg had the legacy that it had in post-war Germany. And in the case of Nuremberg, the world paid with blood and treasure to liberate Europe from fascism, and then, as an act of magnanimity, gave these people their day in court. In the case of Rwanda, in the case of Darfur, we're sitting back allowing people to be slaughtered, and then in a very sort of self-righteous manner, we decide to refer the cases to the International Criminal Court. And I think that clearly justice after the fact cannot be a substitute for intervention while these atrocities are ongoing.
Professor Paya Makhavan, I thank you very much for taking the time. I know you're on a mini vacation with your family, as our listeners can hear, and we're going to have you back to talk about Darfur and to talk about Iran, and particularly what you and I have discussed about Saeed Mortazavi. But I want our listeners just to hear this. When we talk about capital punishment and the inappropriateness of it, it is not to say or to support or to make any equivalency between criminals. I don't think that's Professor Akhavan's position, nor certainly mine. But I want to remind everybody what Albert Camus wrote about capital punishment, which he called acts of public premeditation without equivalency. He wrote that an execution is not simply death. It is just as different from the privation of life as a concentration camp is from prison. It adds to death a rule, an organization, which is itself a source of moral suffering more terrible than death, the most premeditated of murders. Professor Payan Akhavan, thank you very much for taking time to be with us tonight.
My pleasure. Thank you.
We'll have you back shortly on the other issues. Montreal, we'll be back after the news. Well, for those of you just joining us, this was another extended two-hour edition of Last Angry Man. We started at 6 o'clock. Excuse me. And we examined in the first hour, are you getting a fair deal given your income levels? We talked with David Picot of the Toronto City Summit Alliance, who's co-authored an 8-point program for how to make income security fair and how to make our fiscal policies fair to working-class Canadians. And we want to hear from you. Are you getting a fair deal? We then talked to Professor Paya Makhavan, international legal specialist, on whether an opportunity was lost in the Saddam Hussein trial to examine more of what he did, particularly the extermination of so much of the Kurdish population, and the whole issue of capital punishment, even for somebody like Saddam Hussein. And we want to hear from all of you out there about that. And if you're a cell phone user, it's *940 on Rogers and #940 on Bell. And now we turn to Canada. It's time for that reflection of what's gone on in the past year politically and what's gone forward with the guy I consider the most knowledgeable, but more importantly, not most knowledgeable, the guy who really calls it straight, Angelo Persichelli. Happy New Year, first of all.
Happy New Year to you, too, and your listeners, my friend.
Happy, yeah, but you know I hate using that word happy.
Why?
It just irritates me.
Yeah?
Especially now that we're going to talk about Canadian politics. I mean, I don't know how to get happy about it. I want to point out to our listeners that not only can they see your writings in the Hill Times and the Toronto Sun, but also on your own webpage, in my opinion, and it's www.persichelli, PersichiLLI.com. And in November, you wrote Why Dion Will Win, and it almost... It turned out exactly. You said, if all these things fall into place, this is what's going to happen. And that's just about what happened. Where do we go from here? I guess uppermost in everybody's mind going forward is talk of elections.
Well,
is anybody really ready?
Well, Stephen Harper, I think, is. Definitely, because the others are not. And there are many reasons why Stephen Harper would like to have an election. I'm not saying that he's going to push for, but definitely someone is going to push him. He's not going to push back, that's for sure. And there are many reasons. Let's start from the Liberals. First of all, the Liberals, they are not ready. They are not, definitely not ready. From an organizational point of view, they don't have the money they need.
Despite Stéphane Dion bringing in the big tent and putting all his opponents into the same into the front benches.
Oh, well, that just show. We have to see if really he has been successful in unifying the Liberal Party.
Right.
I was talking to some of the operatives in the many previous camps, and still they have doubts. They are saying that there is still a lot of resentment, and they don't believe that the unity is still there. He definitely is going to try. Definitely he has started. Definitely he wants it. If he is going to succeed or not, it's too early to call. But let's pretend that he's going to succeed in its time. And definitely at the present time, he's not ready for an election. He's not ready, as I said, from an organizational point of view. He doesn't have enough money. They don't have the policies. And I don't think he's ready as a leader.
They need time and they need money. Angela, bear with me for just a moment. We got a short, hard break coming up, and then we'll be right back with Angela Persichelli. And we're talking politics with Angela Persichelli, where we've been the past year and what it augurs for the coming year. Angela, you were saying before the break, the Liberal Party's not ready, both on policy grounds and on organizational grounds. You know, we've gone through 13 years of Liberal leaders, the Chrétien Martin clans, the fighting, the division. But one thing that each had their own very dedicated organization. Now, Stéphane Dion doesn't have that on the ground, and he's tried to bring in all these people and cobble out some kind of a place for them within the leadership structure. But what can they deliver on the ground if they're not particularly loyal to any one guy?
Well, that's exactly the point that Stéphane Dion has to face and hopefully to solve. I'm not very optimistic, not because of his ability to do things, but I'm not optimistic because what I hear on the ground is still a lot of resentments, and I do not believe that they are ready for a united party.
And those resentments, it's interesting where they come from. Liberals will tell you, well, no, we're always loyal to the leader and we're loyal to policies, whatever they may be. But the fact is, the past 13 years, the Liberal Party has really been characterized by personality cults, has it not?
Well, absolutely. And actually, it's more than 13 years. If we remember against the fight against John Turner,
yes,
it started in 1984.
You're quite right.
So, and the only reason why Trudeau was able to fix the personality, because everything started when Trudeau arrived. But Trudeau, with his charisma, was able to put everything in place because of his charisma, because they were in government. But the Liberal Party is not the same, definitely not.
I'm not even saying that that's necessarily a bad thing. Strong political leadership is a good thing, but the point is, right now, the Liberal Party is somewhat rudderless.
Absolutely. And this is the proper time. Well, we don't have to forget what happened to Stockwell Day and even to Stephen Harper. Jean Chrétien tried to call an election right after the victory of Stockwell Day in his convention. And Paul Martin tried again to do the same with Stephen Harper. And, I believe that Stephen Harper would be very happy if someone would provoke an election at the present time.
Angelo, we're getting quite a bit of reaction to your comments. Let's just go to one of our callers. Brian, welcome. Good evening. You're on with Angelo Persichelli.
Good evening. You know, the polls are showing that if an election was held, the Liberals would probably will win. So what's he saying? What's Angelo saying? That Stéphane Dion is not ready to be prime minister? The reason they had a 12-month leadership campaign is because they wanted to ride the high or the popularity of the convention into an election. There's going to be an election sooner rather than later, I think.
Well, no, the reason they had a 12, before I let Angelo answer the question, the reason they had a 12-month leadership campaign had nothing to do with that kind of pre-planning. The party was in shambles over Paul Martin's grabbing of the party and manipulation of a lot of events to deflect from his own problems. They had to put a lot of distance, never mind, not to do with Gomery, but to do with Paul Martin himself. But secondly, those polls you referred to, Brian, remember the Liberal numbers have to be over 40% for the Liberals to win, because Liberal voter strength, for even if we don't agree with polls too much or put too much store in polls, Liberal numbers in polls reflect a great deal of concentrated vote in Quebec that doesn't give them the seats.
They're going to take Conservative seats in Quebec, NDP seats in Ontario. They'll get more seats than they got the last time out west. I think saying that the Liberals are not ready for an election is fear.
Angela, what do you say?
Well, I believe that what Brian is saying might happen, but it's not because of the polls. We know that during a convention and after a convention, there is a spillover, there is an effect. I was the president of Polara that had an interview just last week, and he said that Michael Marzolini. He said the polls after the convention shouldn't even be taken, be done, because they are so influenced by what happened during the convention that definitely they will hold no water in 3 or 4 weeks down the road. And I'm not saying that the liberals are not going to win, but definitely the polls are not a good instrument at the present time to prove it.
Brian, remember, Angela's making two other points, that number one, there isn't cohesion within the Liberal Party in terms of the organizations on the ground, and number two, they don't have the money yet. Brian? No, I think we lost Brian. Angela, you were making a point before of how quickly Chrétien called an election to test Stockwell Day, how it had happened earlier. Do you think Stephen Harper's thinking the same thing with Stephen Dion, despite what Brian mentioned as far as the polls?
Well, I believe that Stephen Harper hopes very, very much that someone will provoke an election. I don't think he's going to call an election unless there is something very serious. He's not going to call an election. Nobody likes electorate. They don't like people calling an election when it's not needed. But as I said, if Stephen Harper, if someone is going to push him, definitely he's not going to push back. And he said, and he would welcome something like this. Also because we know that there are going to be elections in Quebec. We don't know when, but we know that the Liberals and the Bloc, they are going to be busy on two fronts. The Conservatives, they don't have a real organization provincially.
Mm-hmm.
So the Conservatives, they could concentrate their effort on the federal elections, while the Liberals and the Bloc, they have to work on two fronts. So if there is an election, the happiest person in Canada will be Stephen Harper.
Angela Persichelli, we'll be right back after a short break, and I want to ask you this question. Regardless of who precipitates an election, do you think that Stephen Dion and Stephen Harper have it in their minds that Canadians are getting a little tired of elections every 18 months? We'll be right back with Angela Persichelli right after this short break. And if you're a cell phone user, *940 for Rogers, *940 for Bell, when our special guest Angela Persichelli of the Hill Times and the Toronto Sun, go to his website, www.persichelli.com, PersichiLli.com. You're going to get the straight talk on Canadian politics. Angela, before the break, we were discussing the possibility of an election. How tired are, is there going to be a backlash against anybody who precipitates an election? I mean, we've gone through two in 36 months.
Well, definitely nobody likes an election, and you are talking to someone that I start politics in Italy, where they were changing government like we are changing our.
Yeah, but there it's a party.
Well, you know that, and I remember when I arrived in Canada when our colleagues were making jokes about Italian politics going to the polls every once a year. Well, since 1993, we went 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and one is coming, or 5 and 1 is coming. It's quite often. Nobody likes an election. But I believe that people, once the elections are called, they concentrate on the campaign. And, if you provoke an election, you must be ready to give an answer. The simple answer is, why you want an election? If you have that answer, you have that answer ready, I think that at that point people are ready to talk to you.
What would Stephen Harper's ideal issue be to run on?
Well, I can say that I need a majority. Otherwise, I can do anything. I have to implement all my policies.
But for that, he would need to show Canadians that the opposition is being firmly obstreperous on something that's grave and vital to the country. What issue could that be? What issue could he even manipulate that to be?
Well, there he can have many issues. He's going to present, for example, he's going to produce a budget in February, and he can put many good things in budget and say, okay, now in order to approve it, I need the majority in the government, either in the parliament. So, you know, it's very easy to prepare a budget that the opposition cannot approve. But the people will really much like it. So the opposition will find themselves in a very awkward, in a very uncomfortable position of supporting a very popular budget, which is good for the government, or say no to a very popular budget, and they will pay if they don't support it with the electorate. So even though he doesn't have the majority, he has good cards to play, and if he plays them right, I think that the opposition is going to have a hard time to stop Stephen Harper.
There's a conventional wisdom that in Canada, elections aren't run on, are not run on foreign policy. Yet foreign policy has been one of the boldest visions that Stephen Harper has given this country, and it's something that there's a wide consensus of pride on the overall strategy, if not on the specific tactics. Could Stephen Harper trigger an election on foreign policy and make it one of the first foreign policy elections in Canada since the war?
Well, he can provoke an election on foreign policy, but he's not going to win on foreign policies. It's the economy, trust, honesty. Those are the things that will eventually decide who's going to be the next prime minister. Foreign policy has never been, well, even in the United States, and more or less in North America, it's the same. George Bush Sr., he was the hero in the foreign policy, but he lost because he couldn't control the economy.
That's what was Clinton's line? It's the economy, stupid, and Tip O'Neill was proved right that everything is local. All politics are local.
It's the economy, stupid. Do you remember that?
Yep.
So I believe that, he can use foreign policies to provoke an election, but if he wants to win, he better have something that is very Canadian.
Final question, Angelo. In the last election, Stephen Harper intimated, more than intimated, talked clearly about wanting to roll back government and roll back statocratic engineering. Is there any way that Stephen Harper can run an election against the Liberal NDP center-left, not saying it's the economy stupid, but saying it's the statism stupid, it's enough? Could he make Canadians understand that?
Well,
that we need a change in the domestic agenda, a change in government's in interference in our lives?
I believe that the Canadians already have bought that kind of ideology. I know we have done it. The question is, are they going to trust the person that is going to present that? And it's a matter of trust. The election is a matter of trust. People, I do not believe that they go into politics and look at if you ask, Stephen Harper, he had the five major policies that he had in mind to implement during his government. I challenge many journalists to remember those five policies.
Mm-hmm.
So what the Canadians, what the electorate is going to look at, is, in my opinion, is they look at TV, they look at the screen, they look at the debate, they say, can we trust those people? Because it's a matter of trust. If they trust you, they vote for you. If they don't trust you, you can say whatever you want. You can tell them that you are going to give the world to them. But if they don't trust you, they are not going to vote for you. So I believe that the major issue every time is going to be trust. And that's why Paul Martin lost, because of the scandals, because of those things. They liked whatever Paul Martin was saying. He was touching every right button. The people didn't trust him.
I think the people understand a deflection and a blanchissage when they see it. Angelo Persichelli, many thanks for taking the time to be with us tonight.
My pleasure, and Happy New Year again.
Thank you very much, and the same to you and yours. And we'll be talking very often in the next few months. I think it's going to be an interesting period running up into the spring.
It's going to be my pleasure.
Montreal will be back right after the news. Bye. Well, if Angelo Persichelli brings us clarity on the nuts and bolts of the workings of the House and the politics on the ground, there are a few people in this country that bring clarity and candor and a courageous voice to questions of the nuts and bolts of policy than Lauren Gunter, a columnist for the National Post and the Edmonton Journal. Lauren, welcome. Thanks for being with us tonight.
Hey, you're welcome. Glad to be there.
I got to tell our listeners, I told Lauren earlier, he has been busier than the proverbial Canadian beaver over the holidays. I'm usually accused of not taking any time off, but Lauren has written on, he's almost written a policy book. He's written on immigration. He's written on crime and punishment. It hasn't stopped. But I want to ask you something different, Lauren.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to start from my end. So I get up today, and I get this pile of newspapers at the door, and 1, 2, 3, lead editorial in a Montreal paper that it's time to get tough on teens buckling up in their cars. Then a story out of Ontario that as of today, if you have a kid, you've got to have a booster seat until the child is either 9 years old or 110 centimeters in height. Then yet another paper on some of the glorious things that our federal government has been spending money on. I'll spare you the provincial ones. StatsCan conducting a national study of 4,000 youngsters that proved that girls scored higher than boys in all categories except curiosity. Another StatsCan study that was a general social survey that found that heavy internet users tend to be homebodies. Yet another one that purported to show that more people enjoyed their commute than did not. And, of course, my all-time favorite for the past year of StatsCan studies, that teenage girls in Quebec were more promiscuous than other parts of Canada. Now, that combined with things like non-anti-smoking laws, anti-perfume laws, God knows what other kind of laws. On a policy basis, I just asked Angelo Persicelli this question. If everything is local, and if the conventional wisdom is Stephen Harper can't run an election on what is arguably his strongest suit, which is a bold new vision on Canada's place in the world, and it's Angelo made the reflection on the 92 American election where George Bush Sr. was a hero and Clinton just killed him with one line, it's the economy, stupid. Is there a chance to wake up Canadians and for Stephen Harper to bring to the forefront one of his major messages, which was that there is too much government interfering in areas that are private domain? Can he run an election on it's statism, stupid, it's enough?
I think he could. I think he has to start softening the ground for that right now. I think part of their problem is that, as new governments are prone to do, they become overwhelmed by the news cycle, by the spin cycle, if you will, in Ottawa, and on issues that, you know, they're pretty smart about. For instance, on global warming, they've simply allowed it to get away from them because they haven't bothered to make the tough, hard arguments that you have to make to convince people that the hysteria from the Al Gores and the environmental lobbies and a whole bunch of scientists, that hysteria is exactly that. It's not very well founded on science. But those are tough things to do.
But why is that? And you've written about this before, that as good as his government is, they've got a problem getting their message out. Why haven't they been able to get this?
They have a problem getting a message out on some things and not others. And I think the thing is that very early on in my involvement in journalism and politics, a wise old politician said to me, you got to pick the hills you're willing to die on.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, sometimes you pick the right hills, and the hills you're willing to die on are the same ones that matter to the public. I think the Conservatives weren't willing to die on the environmental hill, and they hadn't understood the Canadians were very interested in that, particularly central Canadians were very interested in that, particularly urban Canadians. It's one of those issues that exists out there in the abstract.
It's in the ether, yeah.
Yeah, and so that appeals to people who have a lot of time and education, and that then describes an awful lot of urban Canadian voters. The environment to them is not something particularly real. It's something that they hear about over and over and over again. The catastrophe is coming. The hurricanes are wiping out, the southern United States. The Arctic is melting. The polar bears are dying. And to counter all of that, which is largely not particularly true. I mean, there are certain
right
veins of truth to things in there, but it's not entirely true. And B, accepted with religious fervor, so that, as you know, anybody who disagrees with that is...
Oh, yeah, we're the princes of darkness. Lauren, bear with me. We just got to pay some bills. We'll be right back. Very short break. We'll be back with Lauren Gunter. And I'm very happy to be talking to Lauren Gunter, one of the rare sources of clarity and candor in this country. And we're talking about what issues can sell an election. What are the policy issues that we could be looking at if an election is called? And, Lauren, you've called this environment package and this environment issue, and I fully agree, eco-hysteria. And you've just made the point that it plays very well with those who are more educated, more urban. But could I suggest to you that the reason it plays well is because the more educated, the more urban the salon liberal chattering classes are, they don't really want to get down and dirty. We spent 10 days on this show over the holidays He's talking to frontline people who are involved in social action and really bringing relief to those who are suffering. All these wonderful tree huggers, they're not there.
No.
It's an easy issue for them because they don't have to get down and dirty.
Yeah, no, exactly. And it's kind of like mad cow when that comes up. I mean, it's one of those things that they don't like to think about. They have no connection with it. The environment to most urban middle-class voters is the 10 days that they get to spend at the cottage in the summertime. They really haven't got much of a sense of what the world is like beyond the urban limits of the city.
And not only that, their false piety goes further. They say they want to know. They talk about accountability. But this country can't handle the truth. They can't handle what it takes to deliver power to the homes and bread to the shelves. I mean, hell, if I was a prime minister, you know, I'd have you and half a dozen guys around my table. We decide what to do every day. In 4 years, the public doesn't like it, they'll throw us out. The Canadian public have grown so fey and feckless that they hide behind layers of bureaucracy just to avoid seeing what it takes to really run a country.
Well, the examples you were giving at the beginning, the segment before this, where you're talking about, you know, how much time and money is going to be spent convincing teens to buckle up and new regulations in Ontario that you have to put your 9-year-old into a booster seat unless he or she's 110 centimeters tall. I mean, this the nanny state has started to run away with us. And you know, I think there's a relation here to something that I've been writing about a bit lately about dual citizenship. You know, we are probably the most generous country in the world in giving out citizenship. You
Yep.
can get citizenship here after 3 years of permanent resident status, landed immigrant status, even if you haven't spent all three of those years living in Canada. In Norway, if you're not a permanent resident for 9 straight years, don't apply for citizenship because you're not going to get it. You know, a lot of European countries, it's 9 years, it's 6 years, it's 5 years, and you have to be continuously in the country. There's none of this living most of the time back in your old home country just once you have the status. And you can then get, Canadian citizenship rates for tuition at universities. You can get health care. You can get welfare. You can get everything that's available in the social safety net becomes available to you once you have permanent resident status and once you have citizenship status, and we give that away very quickly. And I think that this whole sense of entitlement gets into also the sense that the state will take care of us. The state will make our children safe. The state will give us regulations that we will happily follow that will then keep our teenagers from doing the silly things in automobiles that they do that ends up killing them. And it's this over-reliance on the munificence of the state that just puzzles me. I don't know where it comes from.
And the public can't see that one thing leads to interference in another. You know, one of the problems, and correct me if I'm wrong, about Canadians is they confuse democracy, the fact that they have a right to vote for their government, with freedom.
Yes, of course.
And they think that because they vote for the government can do anything it wants to do, even if it wasn't elected to do it, and that somehow we're a free society because of that. They forget what Tom Jefferson said, that the litmus test of a civility of a society is when the government, how much the government, respects your private domain, whether it stops at your doorstep. Our governments haven't been stopping at any of our doorsteps, not in our houses, not in our cars, nowhere.
No. Queen Victoria was famous for asking permission of peasants and factory workers to enter, to cross the thresholds of their homes, to enter their homes. She would not deign to enter the simplest subject's home without that person's permission. And it was more than just a symbolic act. It was a signal from her that she understood where the power of the crown, which was very much more powerful then
right.
than it is now, where the power of the crown ended. And it ended at your property line. It ended at the threshold into your home. Now, there isn't any idea, no matter how intrusive, that is not entertained by the political classes. It does not matter that they will come into your home and regulate your personal behavior. For instance, like I am not a fan of cigarette smoking.
Mm-hmm.
Don't go to places where there's cigarette smoking. But it's none of my business if a private restaurant owner wants to have smoking in his restaurant, if that's how he wants to cater to his clientele, none of my business. But beyond that, which already angers me, that the forces of nanny statism can tell restaurateurs what they can and cannot allow in their places of business, now there's a move afoot to make it illegal for people who have children below the age of 6 in their home to smoke in their own home. Now, I think it's silly if you have young children that you smoke in your own home. I'll tell you that if you ask me. But I'm not going to use the coercive power of the state to force you to do the thing that you should be intelligent enough to choose to do on your own.
There's a misunderstanding in this country. There's an abdication of individual consequence in this country. There's no longer a separation between the understanding that government should be educational, persuasive, but never coercive or compulsive on things that are in our private domain. There is still a role for family and parents and our own control over our lives.
Democracy is only a handmaiden to freedom when it is limited democracy.
Correct. And as you wrote today, citizenship is not just about privileges. It's about obligations. And if you're not prepared for those obligations, you don't have any responsibility. This country should have no responsibility to stand by. You know, you were talking about that in the context of immigrants. But I would put it to you that many Canadians who look, for example, at the state of our country, the charter, for example, charter rights. They'll talk about the charter of rights. They forget about the freedoms part because that demands them to take responsibility for their lives. And that they're not prepared to do, but they're prepared to imprison everybody else under this false notion of some safety and security. Lauren Gunter, please bear with me. We got to pay some bills. We'll be right back with you. Gunter. Akhavan of McGill University. And we're speaking to one of this country's great repositories of reason and sanity, Lauren Gunter, National Post and Edmonton Journal columnist. Lauren, we're talking about statism and when is enough enough. Lauren, are you getting any feeling across the country that we're ever going to see a time, hopefully soon, where Canadians are just going to stand up like they did in that movie Network, like New Yorkers did in Network? That's enough. We're mad as hell. We're not taking it anymore. You talked about how bureaucrats are talking about sending inspectors into private homes. Well, here in Quebec, we've got Health Quebec now working on grading women's perfumes on alcohol content because there's an allergy lobby that says certain perfumes are irritating people's noses, so they think of making some perfumes illegal.
Yeah.
We're going to have perfume inspectors soon.
There will be...
I know they're mad in the West, and I know they get it, but I mean, nationally, is there any kind of feeling of it's enough already?
You know, I think there always has been. And part of the reason that the establishment likes to scoff and tut-tut at people who disagree with them and suggest that they're somehow mentally inferior is because they'd like to stop debate before they really have to justify a lot of the ridiculous positions that they've taken. I do hold out hope that at some point a group, perhaps this conservative government, perhaps some future government, whatever political stripe, will say enough's enough. Look, this hasn't led to any great advancements of civilization or improvements of the human condition, and so for good or bad, we're just going to stop telling you how to live 97% of your life. You go back to deciding for yourself on the 97%, we'll take care of the 3%. These sorts of things happen because small groups of people decide to stand up and be counted, and then the others follow. One of the great losses of modern political leadership is the lost knowledge that a small group of people is needed who will stick their head above the sand before most people who agree with them are prepared to stand up behind them.
As Emerson's great line, one person resolute abiding by truth shall rally a majority. Lauren, bear with me. Let's go to the line. Sharon, good evening.
Hi, Viral. Happy New Year, both of you.
Thank you. You're on with Lauren Gunter.
Hi, Mr. Gunter. I have a question for you. Yes, I think there's a very big difference between irritants that government impose on us daily, and they're irritants, as compared to... laws, for example, of smoking that really do protect especially children. I heard you say children under 6. I just sent a letter off to the minister telling him that absolutely no smoking where there is a child present.
Well, fine, Sharon. Would you be prepared to have inspectors go into people's private homes?
Well, that's something else. I mean, just an inspector just knocking on your door. I think they have to have some kind of a warrant, wouldn't they?
Well, Sharon, but what Lauren's point was that we have so many statocratic laws, you can't fix every social problem. And they're only enforceable through more bureaucracy, which gives government more power. So you're going to have inspectors floating around on smoking. You're going to have inspectors floating around on perfume. You're going to have inspectors floating around. I mentioned at the beginning of the show this insane law in Ontario that you've got to have booster seats if your kid's 9 years old or not 110 centimeters. So there's inspectors for that. Yeah. They're going to be inspecting every aspect of our life. You're prepared for that? That's living?
No, but I think these are all related to dangerous situations and or health.
But life is dangerous, so don't live life. Don't bring children into the world.
You also have to look at the relative dangers. I mean, if you took your child to a smoky restaurant 4 times a year, it wouldn't be a problem. But I have a 12-year-old and a 10-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
Whose responsibility is it to make sure that they are raised in a healthy manner? Is it mine or is it the government?
Except most parents do not understand the long-term side effects of smoking and children, that it can cause asthma and emphysema. Usually you're right, it's the parents.
But if they don't understand it, Sharon, you can't have government fixing every social problem.
Well,
it just will not happen, and it's just going to imprison everybody else in society.
I'm more upset where governments come out for it right now, changing the name of a street where the majority of the citizens don't want it. And what's the government doing? They're just trampling the rights of the citizen. They're trampling the rights of race.
All right, but that's, you know what? Let me use your word. That's an irritant. And that's not, and that doesn't have, and Lauren, by the way, what she's referring to is that in Montreal, we've got a big thing about Park Avenue being changed to Robert Bourassa Avenue. But we're talking about issues where the government not just irritates the public, Sharon, but sends people into your private domain and controls your life. And that is simply unacceptable.
Well, I don't know. I haven't heard. I've heard of one case of an inspector going into someone's private office, and I think there was a complaint made.
Sharon, we're up against the clock.
Okay.
We thank you for calling.
Okay. Bye.
Lauren, it just does me good to have you on, because out here in the East, it just gets crazier and crazier. You know, Sharon was talking about a case of an inspector. We had one who blitzed our building just to show that he was there, because normally smoke inspectors are show up only when there's a complaint made. And he said, you know, I have a right to go through everybody's drawers. And I said, really? Who told you that? He said, Section 33 of the Act. I said, well, how about Section 7 of the Quebec Charter of Rights and Freedoms? So I said, you have two choices, leave or I call your supervisor. He left.
Good.
I mean, this is how crazy it's getting. They go to your private papers. We're going to keep at it. And as long as there's a community of interest that we strung together, at least there's a watchdog over big government, I think. And Lauren Gunter, more power to you this year, and a healthy year to you and yours.
Thanks, and you too.
And one last thought to all our listeners. As we talk about the statocratic state, remember what Oscar Wilde said in all this false piety of the statocratic bureaucrats. A little sincerity is a dangerous thing. A lot of it is absolutely fatal. Good night to you all. My thanks to Nick Mays of Master Control. We'll be back with you tomorrow night.
We're very fortunate this hour to have as two guests men who have been involved passionately in social action and social reformation and social reconstruction. And one can go in various directions with either, with David Picot on various levels of social and domestic policy. Our next guest, one doesn't know where to start with Paya Makavan, who's a professor of law at McGill University. He's been a lecturer at Yale Law School. He has a remarkable background, first legal advisor to the Prosecutor's Office of the International Criminal Tribunals for the former Yugoslavia and Rwanda, worked with the Human Rights Documentation Center, activist on Darfur, activist on Iranian descent. One can go in any direction with him, and we thank you, Paya Makavan, for being with us tonight. I know that you've got certain domestic responsibilities, but it's okay. It's the first day of the year. It's the first show of the year. But where we'd like to go with you, we're a couple of days away from after the Saddam Hussein execution, and one of your publications has been Beyond Impunity. Can international criminal justice prevent future atrocities? How does this apply to what we've just seen in Iraq? Is this going to stabilize anything?
Well, one of the questions that we always ask in criminal justice is what effect punishment can have. Why do we punish people who've committed crimes? And clearly, at least in modern society, we believe that justice is not about vengeance. Justice is about due process of law. It is about vindicating norms that society considers to be important. And the reason why a criminal justice system works is because of habitual lawfulness. The average person, let's say in Canada, does not even contemplate committing murder, which is why we call crime deviance. When someone commits murder, they've deviated from the social norm, and the job of the criminal justice system is to isolate that person and to bring them to justice. Now, the problem with mass crimes, crimes which are actually perpetrated by the state, such as in Iraq, such as in Rwanda, such as in the former Yugoslavia, is that you have a situation where a crime is the norm, and it's a situation where if anything, crime is elevated to an expression of solidarity and heroism. We've seen this in Bosnia and Rwanda. So in that sort of situation, criminal justice process, a trial such as Saddam Hussein, takes on far greater dimensions, historical dimensions. It's about establishing a historical record. It's about transforming social values. It's about marking a break with an unfortunate past characterized by human rights atrocities and impunity, and ushering in a new culture of accountability, of rule of law and democracy.
Payam Akhavan, I am your student at McGill, right? And I am opposed to capital punishment. We won't get into the statistics. I am intellectually opposed to capital punishment. And I'm also opposed to capital punishment, even in a case like Hussein, even in a case like Eichmann. I think the trial itself is more important. And to me, what is more important for international criminal justice to be effective is if nations embrace things like the responsibility to protect of the International Commission on State Sovereignty and Intervention, which Canada was one of the sponsors of and embraced, yet hasn't put into effect. Am I wrong? Where am I?
Well, I think that you expressed exactly where I was trying to get at, that the trial is more important than the punishment. Hanging Saddam Hussein is not justice, whether you believe in the death penalty or not. It was the trial that was most important in terms of the lessons which the Iraqi people learned. And there, I think, the trial was deeply flawed. That it was really an expression of political opportunism by political leaders in Iraq that wanted to take credit for having hanged Saddam Hussein. And it's a real lost opportunity for the Iraqi people and for the Middle East. What could have been a historical trial was transformed into political lynching. Even if you accept that the death penalty is a valid form of punishment, surely it cannot be executed after a hasty and deeply flawed trial. And the unfortunate thing here is that the victims of most of Saddam's crimes have not received any justice, because the only crime for which he was convicted was the execution of 148 people in the village of Dujail. The vast crimes against the Kurdish,
the Kurds, the gassings.
So it would be like having arrested Adolf Hitler, having tried him for shooting some Polish commissars, and not having prosecuted him for the Holocaust.
Let's draw the parallel for a moment, not to demean the unique historical aspect of the Holocaust, but let's draw for a moment the historical parallel with the Eichmann trial. It's as if you had the Eichmann trial without Auschwitz and concentrated on the killings of 1,000 people in a ditch in a village, which are bad enough, but it was the whole process of opening up the eyes of the world to what really happened.
Exactly. Well, the parallels are interesting, because in the Eichmann trial, the presiding judge, Judge Landau, in the Jerusalem District Court, was himself a Holocaust survivor. And if you read Hannah Arendt's account of that trial, Eichmann in Jerusalem,
yes,
she will explain how the attorney general was trying to transform this into a show trial, and how the judges steadfastly resisted any attempt to turn this into a media circus. And that's why the Eichmann trial has the legacy that it has. Now, in the case of the Saddam Hussein trial, one of the judges was removed because he was seen as being too lenient. Another judge resigned because of political interference. The appeals process took just 3 weeks. In 3 weeks, the appeals court addressed a 300-page submission by the defense on complex questions of law and fact. And the National Security Advisor announced the results of the appeal prior to the appeals chamber itself.
It was a great opportunity missed. Professor Akhavan, just bear with me. We have a very short, hard break. We'll be right back with you.
Thank you.
Right back with Payan Akhavan.